Chief Justice. May it please the court.
I'm Giancarlo Canaparo.
I'm Zach Smith.
And welcome to SCOTUS 101, where we break down what's happening at the Supreme Court, what the justices are up to,
and other things related to our favorite branch of government.
Welcome back to SCOTUS 101.
Welcome back indeed. We have a great episode this week with an interview with Professor John Yu and trivia about what I call the court system's administrative state. But first, GC, why don't you tell us what's new at the Supreme Court this week?
All right. Well, we have no new opinions or cases, but there is one big oral argument to cover, and that is the Food and Drug Administration versus the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine. This case challenges several actions by the Food and Drug Administration to expand access to the abortion drug mifepristone. In 2016 and 2021, the FDA made several changes to the use of this drug. Among other things, it allowed the drug to be used through the 10th week of pregnancy and allowed non-doctors to prescribe it without an in-person visit. Now, a group of doctors sued, arguing that the FDA's decision-making process was arbitrary, driven by politics rather than the expert medical judgment that is supposed to animate the agency's decision-making. At oral argument, the justices focused almost entirely on standing. That is, the requirement that to bring a case, you have to have suffered an injury traceable to the defendant that a court can remedy. In many past cases, almost exclusively brought by liberal challengers to conservative rules and policies on abortion, immigration, and the environment, the court has taken a very expansive idea of standing. Now, for example, doctors may challenge anti-abortion laws on the theory that they are standing in for the interests of their patients. In immigration cases, anyone who has to spend money to comply with a government policy has standing. And in environmental cases, states have standing if they think they might suffer future harms.
So, GC, is it fair to say that standing doctrine today is a bit of a mess, to use the technical term?
an unmitigated disaster.
All right.
Let me explain where this goes from here. So in this oral argument, it sounded like a majority of the justices seem to think that the doctors don't have standing. Now, they argue that they have standing because the FDA's shoddy approval and expansion of access to the drug has hidden the dangers of using the drug, dangers that they have to treat. But Justice Kagan provided, I think, the representative line in opposition, saying that their view of standing was, quote, very probabilistic. Now, Justice Alito, on the other hand, pointed out the problem that if the doctors can't sue, nobody can. And in fact, the Solicitor General did, in fact, take the position that if the government did something wrong here, nobody can sue. And Alito wondered, you know, how can it possibly be right that the government can get away with enacting unlawful rules and regulations? So standing is not the most exciting legal issue to a lot of people. But as I've argued quite a lot elsewhere, it's supremely important. It's also a great barometer of judicial integrity. So Justice Kagan, for example, has endorsed wildly speculative theories of standing in the past, and I imagine will do so again when conservative laws and policies are challenged. But in this case, she'll advocate for a restrictive rule. And that, in a nutshell, is why standing doctrine is, to use a technical term, a mess.
Or an even more technical term, an unmitigated disaster.
So, you know, if the court holds that the doctors don't have standing, there could be a silver lining in this case if the justices at least try to develop some sort of more consistent and less exploitable rule that governs future cases. But I don't hold my breath.
Very interesting. Well, I know we'll certainly have to wait and see. And it'll be interesting to see what the justices decide in this case. Stay tuned for my interview with Professor John Yu right after this, where we talk about some of the upcoming issues in the Trump immunity case, and he tries to answer the question of whether originalism can be moral.
Conservative women are problematic women. Why? Because we don't adhere to the agenda of the radical left. Every Thursday morning on the Problematic Women podcast, Kristen Eichammer, Lauren Evans, and me, Virginia Allen, are joined by other conservative women to break down the big issues and news you care about. Whether you're interested in hot takes and conversations on pop culture or what Congress is up to, Problematic Women has you covered. We sort through the news to keep you up to date on the issues that are of particular interest to conservative-leaning, that is, problematic women. Find Problematic Women wherever you like to listen to podcasts and follow the show on Instagram.
We're pleased to be joined today by an old friend of the program, Professor John Yu. He has a long list of titles, but he serves as the Emanuel S. Heller Professor of Law at Berkeley Law, serves as a non-resident or visiting fellow at several think tanks, and he is delivering this year's Edwin Meese III Originalism Lecture at the Heritage Foundation. John, welcome back to the show.
Zach, it's great to see you here in Washington after spending a fraught few days with you in Berkeley, where we survived the Berkeley Heritage Criminal Law Conference, where you took on the likes of Chesa Boudin and his followers. And so that was great, actually. It was wonderful for Berkeley to have you, Heritage, come out there. And I hope we have set a precedent, and now you're going to take the tour on the road and visit all kinds of unwilling law schools and their students and teach them about what's really going on with the criminal justice system.
Well, I'm happy to be the riffraff wherever I go. Still have the battle scars from my encounter with Chesa and the other folks there, but really appreciate you helping to set that up for us. It was a great event. Well, I want to talk today a little bit about your originalism lecture that you're going to deliver at the Heritage Foundation. But before we do, given your expertise in issues surrounding presidential authority and presidential immunity, I'm hoping we can talk a little bit about the upcoming Supreme Court case, Trump versus United States. We had Josh Blackman join us several weeks ago to talk about Trump versus Anderson, the ballot case. And so now I thought it'd be useful for our listeners to swing around and talk about the immunity case. Just to remind our listeners, the court is set to hear arguments in the case on Thursday, April 25th, and barring some unforeseen circumstance, it'll be the last case argued before the court this term. John, if you don't mind, can you remind our listeners about the procedural history of the case and some of the issues involved?
Sure. It's an interesting case, first ever, because no president has been prosecuted ever. And so this question of does a president have immunity from criminal prosecution by the federal government has never arisen before. I'm not surprised the Supreme Court took the case. It's, if you're going to have as momentous an issue as that decided by the federal judiciary, I think it should be the Supreme Court that makes a final decision, just like they made the final decision in the Watergate tapes case, right? You know, U.S. versus Nixon back so many years ago. So this arises out of Jack Smith, the special counsel.
Important caveat, Jack Smith, not Zach Smith. Different person.
Are we sure about that?
100%.
I mean, you have more hair than him, but other than that.
Now, that's not something many people say, but I'll take it.
So Jack Smith has brought an indictment against President Trump for the events surrounding January 6th, although he's charged him with unusual crimes. For example, he's not charged him with insurrection or sedition. Right. He's charged him for committing basically fraud on the United States, interfering with congressional processes, and violating everybody's voting rights, actually, in the whole country.
Right.
So President Trump raised immunity. He said, I can't be prosecuted for conduct that is, in his words, at the outer perimeter, quote unquote, of his constitutional authority. So that issue was he lost at the trial court before Judge Chutkan, no surprise. He lost at the D.C. Circuit. You might remember that the special counsel tried to leapfrog the D.C. Circuit, go right to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, no, 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 Smith, you lose again, back to the D.C. Circuit. And so the D.C. Circuit actually, in a quick fashion but not hasty, issued a lengthy opinion denying the idea that a president has immunity from prosecution, announced before the Supreme Court. One other thing to emphasize, which I think is lost a little bit, is there's a difference between immunity and whether the prosecution is actually constitutional in its charges. Immunity just means it doesn't matter what I'm being prosecuted for. I can't be brought as the president or former president into federal court for prosecution. I'm just completely not subject to the power of the court. That's immunity. That's different. Trump, and we can talk about the substance of it, but Trump could lose on the immunity and still win on all his arguments against the legality of the indictment.
Now, you mentioned he's arguing that his acts that fall within the outer perimeter of his authority are immune from prosecution. What does that mean, the outer perimeter of his authority? Why is that important in this case?
Well, we're not sure exactly, right? Because, you know, these courts have all rejected this right out of hand, so they're not even interested in figuring out where that line might be.
Sure.
But suppose you thought Trump was right. You still have to go and decide what things did he do were within the outer perimeter or of his constitutional authority, and what things did he do were in his private capacity. So there's actually another case going on in the D.C. Circuit where there's an opinion been issued, which is a civil lawsuit brought against President Trump by the Capitol Hill police who were injured on January 6th. Mm. And so there the D.C. Circuit said President Trump's activities on January 6th, or at least some of them, were not within any definition of authority of his presidential acts if they had to do with his reelection. So the D.C. Circuit basically set out this kind of dichotomy. If you're doing things for reelection, if you're acting as the head of a political party, you are per se not the president, because we don't want a president, right, using the powers of his office or her office to influence the election, give themselves an unfair advantage. So that's one way we could tell. Outer perimeter goes up to, but does not include, the things you do as a candidate for office or as a member of the Republican Party, as opposed to things you do as a president. Now, so President Trump is going to say, well, the indictment basically attributes the incitement of the insurrection to me in my speech at the Ellipse. And he would say, presidents give speeches all the time. That's what presidents do. Giving that speech, not just protected by the free speech clause in my First Amendment rights, but also protected by the outer perimeter of my authority as president, which is to comment on public affairs. And then he would also say, not just the speech on January 6th, but to the extent I tried to influence Vice President Pence and how he counted the electoral votes, to the extent I tried to discuss with members of Congress or members of state legislatures, well, I'm the president. If I honestly believe that an election has been fraudulently taken, I'm the president. I execute the laws. Why can't I go out and try to make sure the laws are enforced in the way I interpret them as president?
Now, there are a number of briefs filed in this case, including amicus briefs. Are there any amicus briefs or friend of court briefs that particularly stand out to you in this case?
You know, the thing is, is that I think the arguments are all well ventilated in the sense that I think we all know what the arguments are going to be. In fact, I tend to think that Trump's probably going to lose on the immunity question. But like I said, that doesn't settle. I think he has really good claims, for example, on whether what he did constitutes fraud, because the Supreme Court has already said when politicians are prosecuted for fraud, you have to show that money or property was at stake, that that was changing hands. Trump's not running for money or property. He's whatever it is, it's to maintain his position as a politician. I don't think that's fraud. Or you could say interfering with congressional processes. Well, that's really that's part of the Sarbanes-Oxley law that was written about congressional investigations. Mm. No, this is not a congressional investigation. This is, you know, President Trump making his case to Vice President Pence about how to count the electoral votes. And Trump could say, I didn't actually coerce or do anything. I asked Mike Pence to do this. He didn't do what I asked him to do. And that was it, right? How's that illegal interference with the congressional process? And the voting rights issue, I mean, come on, right? He's like, I didn't stop anyone from voting. I didn't stop any vote from being counted, right? He's just saying, when it gets to the electoral vote question, that's totally different. That's not an inhibition of anyone's voting rights. So I think actually all the arguments are out there. I don't know, how would I say it? I mean, it's not that you shouldn't write amicus briefs, but when it's a question of this kind of importance that people have been talking about, thinking about for so long, I think all the arguments are known by now. But Zach, if there are any briefs that you liked that you would ask me about, please do. But since I teach presidential power, I sort of, you know, I feel like I, you know, these are arguments that have been well known and debated since,
right,
I mean, since the time of Thomas Jefferson went after Aaron Burr.
I think that's generally right. You know, many of these arguments have been briefed in the lower courts. And even when this case first came up to the Supreme Court on the initial application for stay that the court treated as the petition for cert and granted. You know, I know right before we went on the air, we were talking briefly about one brief that was filed by former Attorney General Ed Meese, mm-hmm. Gary Lawson, Stephen Calabresi, and some other folks as well that deals with the appointment clause. Mm-hmm. Issue of the special counsel. I thought that was an interesting argument.
That actually is a very interesting argument, whether Jack Smith's appointment and could be Zach Smith's appointment here at Heritage too, whether they're both illegitimate.
Different people.
Yours is not unconstitutional, just illegitimate. His is unconstitutional.
Many would agree with that.
Yeah. I mean, this is an interesting argument. I don't think this court is going to take it up in the sense that I feel, and I don't disagree with them actually, but I feel what they're doing is asking the court to overrule Morrison versus Olson, which said that the special counsel of that time, who actually was independent from the attorney, or could not be fired by Attorney General President, was not a principal officer of the United States, so could be appointed in that weird day by the D.C. Circuit.
Right.
So the argument here is, well, Jack Smith, special counsel, because of his independence and freedom in conducting this investigation, his lack of accountability to the attorney general seems to be a principal officer. This was, you know, the argument that Ted Olson made at the Supreme Court in Morrison versus Olson. The Supreme Court rejected it. The reason I don't think it'll fly is because I don't think the Supreme Court right now is of a mind to go back and reexamine Morrison. I think if they did, they would ask for a wholly new briefing about the question. And so I think they might just say, we're going to accept – you know, Jack Smith's appointment and proceed to the constitutional issues. I mean, it is a great off-ramp for the court if it wanted to not decide this question. But I think if they really wanted to go down this route, it would take a lot of heavy lifting and they would certainly ask for more briefing and questions about it, which they haven't done yet.
Right. Well, if we fast forward to April 25th, the day of the argument, is there anything in particular we should be looking for in terms of certain justices or where their focus might be or any other interesting things that might come up at the argument itself?
Well, one is, as you may know, there's a case called Nixon versus Fitzgerald, which says that presidents have absolute immunity from civil lawsuits. Mm. So one thing to look for is how much do the justices rely on Nixon versus Fitzgerald to establish a framework for criminal immunity. So basically the arguments Trump is making, I think, come from Nixon versus Fitzgerald, the idea that if presidents are subject to damages lawsuits, then they will suffer bad incentives in making decisions now. Mm. You know, they'll be looking over their shoulder all the time about whether they'll be sued. Do you see the current justices thinking this kind of case is really an extension of Nixon versus Fitzgerald, or is it completely different? So that's one. A second one is, and I think this would be important to justices that have served in the executive branch, like Brett Kavanaugh, the Chief Justice, Sam Alito, particularly who are all in the Justice Department, Elena Kagan, Solicitor General. They'll wonder, when you talk about the protecting the institution of the presidency, whose job is that? Is it the court's job or is it the current president's job? I could see them saying, well, the person who's really the institutional owner of the integrity of the presidency, its ability to act, protecting its constitutional authorities, is the person who's president now, not the person who was president before. Mm-hmm. They've said that in other areas involving executive privilege, for example. Are they going to say that applies here? And if it applies here, that means the president now decides how to protect the prerogatives of the office by choosing whether to prosecute or not. Would they see the court getting involved as a kind of an intrusion into the president's control of the executive branch? That's another thing I would look out for.
Okay. Well, very interesting. Well, obviously, this is a very important case, and I think all of us will be watching it closely, certainly on April 25th, but even in the weeks afterwards as we wait for a decision. I want to shift gears now, if we can, a little bit, John. I want to talk about the topic of your Meese Originalism lecture this year. The title of it is "Can Originalism Be Moral?" And I know the last time you were on the show, you said you hated giving elevator pitches for
different
speeches.
Did I say that last time?
You did. You did. But I'm hoping you'll give us the elevator pitch for your speech and tell us, why did you pick the topic of can originalism be moral?
Originalism is triumphant right now at the Supreme Court, where the last appointment, Justice Jackson, said she was an originalist. Someone appointed by President Biden, someone you would not have expected to be an originalist. But while it's interesting, while—
Now, do you think she's actually an originalist?
She may think she's an originalist, but at least we're, calling it the same game.
Sure.
But the interesting thing is, as originalism has finally won, there are now a lot of doubts, primarily amongst conservatives, about original. There's always been the kind of 1619 Project attack on originalism because the founders were bad people, or the founders didn't represent everybody in the country, so why should we pay them any deference? But that's not where the argument's coming from. It's coming from conservatives like my friend Adrian Vermeule,
right,
has a book called Common Good Constitutionalism, gotten a lot of attention, saying that originalism is not a moral theory and we should instead judge the outputs of Supreme Court decisions and our political order against some kind of external moral value system. And he would say, let's use the law of the approach of the civil lawyers,
right,
going back to Cicero, really, and say, do the decisions and the rules advance the common good? But you also have longer held criticisms from like the Claremont School, I'd say represented right now by Hadley Arkes, who say there should be some kind of natural rights morality that fills in the gaps of the Constitution, gives words meaning in the Constitution. But they also would be critical, I think, of the way originalism is practiced. They have been critical.
Right.
Their leader, Harry Jaffa, was very critical of Judge Bork. I wish it was Justice Bork. Of Judge Bork and Justice Scalia, for example, as it Hadley Arkes.
Well, and Hadley Arkes and Judge Bork, I know, had lengthy exchanges on topic.
Oh, yeah. Jaffa, Arkes, Bork, Scalia, they all had these exchanges,
right,
about to what extent does external moral systems come into the interpretation of the Constitution. So I thought, as a practitioner of originalism, but not someone who writes about interpretive theory, I would take a dive into this and try to explain from my own point of view why originalism does have some kind of moral basis. Mm. And if I had the 30-second explanation, and I'm still working on the speech, even though it's in about 30 minutes. Inspiration comes best under pressure, I find.
Happy to help the creative process.
My idea is that all these values, common good constitutionalism, Hadley Arkes' view, natural rights, or even Randy Barnett's view about libertarianism, none of them are possible without the nation state. And in particular, the American nation state. So I have a kind of American exceptionalism view. I could see where, in general, other countries, Europe, Asia, the nation state itself does not have a particular, moral standing, because all those countries, their people that exist before their, their temporary nations that they happen to be in now. There's France. French people exist before the French Constitution. They've been through five of them, I think, in the last 200 years. I think the United States is different. The Constitution actually creates our nation. And so if we think that the principles that the United States has been founded on and that it advances are good, then I think the Constitution is good and that originalism is good. So that's one. The second is, to give rise to the nation state, we had to make compromises. We had to, the North and the South had to agree. In order to agree and to build a nation state, they had to be able to make promises to each other to follow a certain set of rules. That's what the Constitution is. If we start to dispense with the original understanding of that bargain that different regions in the country made, different groups of people made, because I think the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment are a commitment from the government and the states and the people to the American people as a whole to respect certain rights. Mm. If we undo those, then we make it very difficult, if not impossible, in the future for the American people to, again, make decisions and bargains and compromises that are necessary to the functioning of a nation state. And without an American nation state, all those values from all those people are not going to be possible to be attained.
So if we get down to brass tacks, the title of your talk is Can Originalism Be Moral? It sounds like your answer is unequivocally yes.
I'd say half-hearted yes.
Why the half-hearted?
Because I'm not saying that originalism itself or any interpretive approach is moral or immoral. It's just a technique. Mm-hmm. It falls back on whether you think the Constitution itself is moral. Has to be, right?
Yes.
Like, I wouldn't say, like, you know, like the canon of nociter ad socis has a moral content to it, right? It depends whether the law you apply canons to is moral.
But it's fair to say if we decide the Constitution and the values underlying it that are moral, then originalism would be moral as well.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, people like a Bork or a Scalia, I think they might have gone too far and being positivist and saying, well, the Constitution itself is not really moral. All it does is it creates a system of government, and then the outputs of the government may be moral or not moral. But the government itself is, right, the Constitution itself is, you know, relatively content-free. Mm.
But your argument is that there are some values imbued with the Constitution and the structure of our government itself.
Yes, because it creates the American nation, which has been, I think, an unparalleled force for good in the world and for, of course, all of us who live here, without parallel in history or without parallel to any other country existing now, I would
wholeheartedly
say.
Agree. Excellent. Well, I hope all of our listeners will tune in and listen to your excellent lecture. It will be available on heritage.org and other sources, and I'm sure it will be a great event. I do want to ask you two other very quick questions. Last time you were with us, you mentioned that you're working on a book on Alexander Hamilton's constitutional thought. I want to check in, see how that's going, and see when we might be able to pick up a copy.
You make me feel so bad I'm spending my time here instead of working on the book. So, I'm still working on it. It's a very large project. And I have to say I've had to stop and work on other books in the meantime. But that's my main – yes, that's still my main project. I'm still working on it. I hope I could finish the manuscript within about a year from now. But – Hamilton wrote too much for our own good.
Well, it'll be a good excuse to have you back on the show whenever the book comes out. And then finally, of course, you answered this last time you were here, but I want to see if you may change your answer. We have a question we ask all of our guests here on SCOTUS 101. If you could have a conversation with any justice, living or dead, who would it be and what would you talk about? And I think last time
you mentioned – Yeah, I was going to say, what did I say last time?
Well, you mentioned Justice Marshall, and then you said we were asking the wrong question. We should actually ask who besides a justice would we want to talk about the Constitution and legal thought
yes,
and theory
that's
with?
True.
And you said Alexander
Hamilton.
Yeah,
and of course it would be Alexander. So I'm kind of doing that with my book. Yeah. No, actually the answer is probably the same. I would rather want to talk to Alexander Hamilton, maybe James Madison. Although he seems to have been a very annoying little fellow from what I can tell.
How so?
Well, you read descriptions of Madison and he's like the little guy in the back taking all the committee notes. I think Thomas Jefferson also would have been interesting to talk about the Constitution, although I probably would have disagreed with a lot of what he thought. Mm. And I don't particularly admire Jefferson as a person. But Alexander Hamilton, I think, had great insight, and I admire him as a person. So I'd still stick with Hamilton.
Now, I was told to ask you, what are your thoughts on Hamilton the play? Is that an accurate depiction of Alexander Hamilton's life?
I actually still am not watching it.
Okay. All right, fair enough.
I really should, but I feel so ripped off by the thing because as I spent a lot of my career writing and thinking about Hamilton.
And then it stole the thunder in the room.
So I'm going to – I think I said this last – so I think the thing to do is to produce a musical about Madison.
Okay. Well, we'll stay tuned for that. Professor Yu, thank you for joining us on the show today. Fascinating conversation as always, and we look forward to having you again in the future.
My pleasure. Great to be with you.
GC, we hear a lot about the Supreme Court and issues surrounding its rules and procedures and how it does business, but we hear a lot less about how policies are set for the lower federal courts. And I get the sense that this process is somewhat of a black box. And I know there have been several controversial policies coming out of this judicial administration apparatus over the past several weeks and months. So I thought this would be the perfect time to tackle some trivia about how policy is made for the lower federal courts. Are you ready?
Well, you know, a friend of mine and a podcast co-host, in fact, has written something or other about this, which I did, against my better judgment, read. So I feel like, yes, I might very well be ready for this.
Well, you know, sometimes gadflies just, you know, put out stuff, and I'm glad to know folks read it every once in a while. But in all seriousness, I have written several pieces about some of these controversial policies and some of the issues surrounding them. And so if other folks are interested, we'll post links to those articles in the show notes. All right, GC, let's see how closely you read my articles with these trivia questions.
<Uh-oh>.
All right, first up, what body serves as the principal policymaking body for the federal courts? According to its website, it convenes twice a year to consider administrative and policy issues affecting the federal court system and to make recommendations to Congress concerning legislation involving the judicial branch.
This is the Judicial Conference of the United States.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And this Judicial Conference was in large part the brainchild of then Chief Justice William Howard Taft. He successfully lobbied Congress in 1922 to establish the Conference of Senior Circuit Judges to serve as the principal policymaking body concerned with the administration of the United States courts. Now, Congress slightly revised the composition of this body and formally changed the name to the Judicial Conference of the United States in 1948, and Congress has made further changes to the composition of this body throughout the years, too. But essentially, we owe its existence to Chief Justice William Howard Taft. Well done, GC. Now, speaking of the composition of the Judicial Conference, can you tell me who serves as members of this conference?
Well, given that Taft originally named it the Conference of Senior Circuit Judges, I'll assume there are circuit judges who serve, but that must have changed, right?
Because
I know now that there are district court judges on it too.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You're mostly right in your answer. And in fact, Congress formally added district judges to serve as part of the conference in 1957. Today, the Chief Justice serves as the presiding officer of the Judicial Conference, and the Chief Judge of each judicial circuit, the Chief Judge of the Court of International Trade, and a district judge from each regional circuit, who is elected for a term of not less than 3 nor more than 5 successive years, as established by a majority vote of all circuit and district judges of the circuit he or she represents. All of these individuals serve as members. So well done on that question as
well.
Thank you. All right. Now, while the Judicial Conference oversees many policy and administrative tasks related to the courts, it accomplishes its work through a vast array of committees. How many committees does the Judicial Conference have?
Geez, I hear the phrase vast array of committees and that's just not a good development. I don't know, but I'm concerned by the answer, whatever it is.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right to be concerned. And this in part is why I have started referring to the Judicial Conference and the Administrative Office of U.S. Courts as this administrative state of the court system, because there is a vast bureaucratic apparatus that has been set up within the judicial branch of government. Now, in terms of the number of committees that the Judicial Conference has, there are 25. And Chief Justice John Roberts talked about many of these committees in his 2021 end of the year report on the federal judiciary, where he said that the work of these committees range, quote, from the rules of procedure to budget to security, conduct and disability, information technology, and space utilization. But as we'll talk about in just a minute, unfortunately, the work of many of these committees has strayed into some troubling territory as well. So in terms of who is part of these committees, GC, who appoints the members of these Judicial Conference committees?
Well, I hope that it would be the Chief Justice. I don't see many constitutional alternatives besides the Chief Justice.
Well, that's exactly right. The Chief Justice has the sole authority to make committee appointments. And as a general rule, according to the Judicial Conference's website, committee appointments are for a term of 3 years and are subject to one reappointment. So well done. All right, I'm going to throw you a little bit of a more challenging question, but maybe not, if you've been paying attention to the news or if you read a certain Gadfly's articles over the past few weeks. This involves the recent controversy where the Judicial Conference unwisely waded into political waters and tried to change how district courts assign their cases, largely in response to criticism from some on the left. So here's my question to you, GC. Does the Judicial Conference have this power to determine how district courts make their case assignments?
Well, according to a particularly dubious source, the answer is no. But
Congress? Are you referring to Congress?
But you have on your side no lesser light than Josh Blackman. So I'm inclined to agree with the both of you.
Well, I certainly appreciate that. Yeah, you're exactly right. In fact, there's explicit statutory authority that says that district courts are responsible for deciding how cases are assigned within each of their respective districts. And as you mentioned, Josh Blackman's written about this extensively at the Volokh Conspiracy. I've written about it at the Daily Signal. And if folks are interested, they can read more about it at either one of those places. And as I mentioned earlier, if you're interested in some of the other problematic policies coming out of the Judicial Conference or the Administrative Office of U.S. Courts, you can read more about it at the Daily Signal. I published an article about some of the problematic DEI initiatives that are coming out of these bodies recently. And again, we will post those articles in the show notes as well. GC, well done on trivia today.
Thank you. Guess I got lucky that I decided not to ignore that email from you.
Never should you ignore an email from me, but too many people do. Well, that's all we have for today. So thank you to everyone for listening to SCOTUS 101. Please be sure to subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you listen. And as always, we'd appreciate if you left us a 5-star rating.
You can follow us on X at SCOTUS101 and email us at SCOTUS101@heritage.org with your questions, comments, or ideas for future shows.
You've been listening to SCOTUS 101, brought to you by more than 500,000 members of the Heritage Foundation. Executive produced by Giancarlo Canaparo and Zach Smith. Sound designed by Lauren Evans, Mark Guiney, and John Popp. For more information, visit heritage.org.